Hello and welcome back to the Caddisfaction podcast. Today is our second ever episode. So those who are returning, thank you for coming back. And those who are listening to this for the first time, thank you for joining us. Today I am talking to a good friend of mine, Sarah, who did an apprenticeship scheme rather than the university or straight into it route. And it's something that I've never actually spoken to her much about. So it's going to be a bit of a rabbit hole. We could go off in all sorts of directions. So hopefully it's a good one.
Catch it, draw it, make it, change it, fix it, make it, save it, share it. Caddisfaction. This is the Caddisfaction podcast. Caddisfaction.
So we should kick this off by actually letting people know who the hell you are. I talked briefly in the last podcast about you. You freelance for me every so often, so I've convinced you to join me on this and twisted your arm a little bit.
I jump into frame and I jump back out again, don't I?
Yeah, you have your moments. But what's really interesting, how I wanted to start this podcast was, although about CAD, was actually a journey of getting there. And your story is a little bit more less known to me because I went down the sick form A-level, UCAS, had the careers advisor who said I was mad to go into theatre, don't do it, it's not a career, you're not going to earn money, you're going to be on the streets. Maybe not that extreme, but they weren't for it. They were just like, are you sure? We're not sure this is the right move for you.
And wait, did they preempt COVID?
What would that have been? That would have been 13 years in advance they preempted COVID. I'm not on the streets, guys. It's fine. It's not so bad. But it's tough.
That
but
helped.
You went down the apprenticeship route, government scheme, and I know that there's levels, but I have no idea how you get into that, because obviously you went to school, you can speak English, you have an education, which is good. Where the hell do you start?
Well, my journey is a bit of a weird one, I have to say. It's one of those ones that I fell into without even realising. Because it took me an extra 2 years to do sixth form because I had some health problems at the time. And so I kept taking a year out and a year back in. And so I knew after those extra 2 years, it took me 4 years to do sixth form.
You were just living the dream. You just didn't want to leave, did you? That was it.
No, it was more like, please let me finish. Please, please. I don't want to do this anymore. That aside, I did really enjoy my subjects, and I did maths and graphic design and photography, and those are still three passions of mine still to this day. How many years ago was this? About 6-7 years ago now that I finished sixth form. Because it took me so long to do that education bit, I knew I didn't want to go to university because I was fed up. I didn't want to do any more education.
So it was a conscious decision. It wasn't just university was an option. It was just actually the suit.
Oh, it was an option. It was absolutely an option. But you know what schools are like, and wanting to meet their quota of university students. And they really did push me. And I just kind of, you know me with my attitude.
You have a strong character where when you have your mind set on something,
yeah,
it's not that it's impossible to deter you, but you want to see something through, and that's a good characteristic to have. I wouldn't call it, you know, some people would mislabel that as an attitude. You have your moments.
You know, I'm strong-minded in a sense, and I knew when I set my heart to something, I was going to do it, and I knew the path of university just really wasn't for me because it had taken me so long with education, and I just thought I need a break, I need to do something else, even if it's a gap year. But you know, school kept pushing, and I just kept pushing back, saying, you're not listening to me, you need to listen to me. So
Find
I decided
it.
That I wanted to not do university, and decided to just go and do something graphic design related because I really enjoyed that, and I did really well, and all my art teachers were driving me for that. So I actually had set up a work experience as an office assistant in a graphic design company that do the posters and the booklets for the NHS.
Okay, yep.
And I was all prepared to go to them, and then my mum saw on you know, she as a mother, you worry. And she did a little bit of browsing. And if you know my mother, she faffs, and she faffs to the extent of, we'll just do things for me.
I'm half expecting to walk in during this, by the way.
Oh, I have put a do not disturb sign on the door.
Oh, okay, that's good. That's good. Because normally she'll walk in and go, who's that? Oh, it's Ollie. No, but parents do watch out for you. Like my mum, did my UCAS, I was set up to do medicine. You know, I was doing biology, chemistry, and DT as my A-levels. And I was set up to do medicine. I'd done all the pre-courses. Mm. And then night before UCAS happened, I actually changed everything. Cancelled my, what was it, three choices you get, changed my personal statement, applied to one university, the Central School of Speech and Drama, applied for one course on a roll of a dice. And yeah, it all panned out, thank God. And that was just from the words of my mother, going, don't do what you think you should do, do what you want to do and what you feel you can do. If someone says you can't do something, there's nothing wrong with turning around and saying, I can do this.
I completely agree. It was more of a kind of, because she had seen me struggle with sixth form, she wanted to offload some of that pressure, because I was just kind of, this is the next step. And I remember having this little journey map on the fridge, because it was, I had to focus on something, otherwise I felt like I wasn't going anywhere. So we mapped out this little journey thing, and so she was just browsing online one day and came across the apprenticeships website, and she saw that there was one going for a digital drawing and design apprentice at the National Theatre.
Oh, so it was purely your mum that actually thrust you into that direction.
Because you were going down the...
Oh, I never knew that. Because the graphic, the photography, I was like, okay, very artsy, we get that. But so theatre purely came... Obviously, you had a passion for theatre separately. I know this...
Oh, yeah, I absolutely love, you know, theatre. I've seen loads of shows by that point.
But I had no idea that that was the final thrust. And you ended up in CAD?
Yeah.
Like, photography, art, and not to say that CAD's not artistic in any way, but, you know, it's quite a crossing.
I did a lot of my graphic design on the computer, and a lot of photography work was editing on the computer, so I was really tech savvy in the sense of that.
You weren't afraid of a mouse?
Oh, no. And so I actually remember saying to her, No. And as you do as a teenager, you're just like, butt out of my life, Mum. Stop trying to force this on me. And I think it was like 2 days before applications closed, I turned around to her and said, actually, can we actually apply for this?
Okay.
And we stayed up all night making my application and compiling my portfolio. And I didn't think I'd get it in a million years, because I was like, oh no, I don't know enough about theatre, I don't know enough about this. And to my surprise, you know, the National Theatre reached out, and the lovely Kath, who is the apprenticeship manager there, got in touch and offered me an interview. And I remember the first rounds, and I remember meeting you for the first time.
Oh, no.
I remember, and it was a interview process where it was like speed dating, and it was like 2 minutes on each table in a circle.
It was up in the church windows, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Oh my God, it was the most, like, the horriblest experience I've ever had in my entire life. And I remember it was you and various other people in the office, and the head of the drawing office, all interviewing.
I think we can say it was Nick. I don't think it was.
It was Nick.
And I want to say it was Emma, one of the Emmas, because that narrows it down.
Yeah, one of the Emmas, and I think Al.
We should explain for those who don't know, at the National Theatre, as you walk in the public side, you've got a lot going on. You've got the cafes, you've got the bars, and then you've got the lifts by the main staircase by box office. Two floors up, there's an area that we call the church windows, because they're floor-to-ceiling glass, and you're probably like 20, 30 foot high panes of glass, and there's like installed leather banquettes, best way of describing it. And so, yeah, we did the apprenticeship interviews there, and I think memory serves, we were all given a singular question to ask.
Yeah, and we had 2 minutes and then a bell would ring.
Yeah, and then it was on to the next and you had to...
And it was on to the next. It was so dehumanising.
But
because
the answers
you wanted
were
to get across. You wanted to get across everything, but you couldn't in those 2 minutes. And I think I remember one of the questions was, if you were on a desert island, mm-hmm. what would you build as your shelter or whatever? And I remember being like, well, you know, near a water source and high up in the treetops, away from any like predators and stuff. And
highly
practical. I was like, what has this got to do with it? Because I still didn't know exactly what the drawing office did. I remember, oh, that was it. I thought you did all the, because it was digital drawing and design. I thought initially that you guys did all the artwork for the programs and the posters. And so, surprise, surprise, it was the set. And I was like, oh, I am way out of my depth there. And I thought I did really abysmal in the round. And then, again, to my surprise, I got a call back to a one-on-one meeting. And I think it was down to me and one other girl. And I got it, and I couldn't believe it. And I was so overwhelmed, and I still have felt like, even after my first week, I had imposter syndrome. Like, you know, I felt like an imposter. I didn't know what I was doing. I had no idea. But that was all part and parcel of being an apprentice, you know. You learn from the ground up. And my God, did I learn from the ground up. I went to, and in partnership with that, I went to college to learn CAD,
yep.
Especially AutoCAD. And I think I went every Friday or something like that. And it would be a City and Guilds CAD centre, and it was all the way in Canary Wharf. So me being West London and that being...
Yeah, a bit of a trek. At least it wasn't too bad.
No, it wasn't too bad. For one day a week, it wasn't too bad. But I remember getting assessed quite a lot and it being very stressful. And the more and more I learned, the more and more Nick gave me more challenging work and really wanted to test my skills. And he was a great manager, absolutely fantastic. Really nurtured what my skill was. And
it's a very fast-paced office in there.
And if anybody knows Nick Murray, you know he's a very fast-paced man, even especially the way he talks.
Not in Lent, though, when he's off caffeine.
Oh, yeah. I remember those Easters where he would just be off caffeine and you just about could get your notes written down when you're talking to him now.
Still fair play to him. He ran, you know, it was a new... I suppose it's gone through so many names. The DDD office, the drawing office. It's one of those new departments where nobody really totally understands what it does, or certainly in those years, because I think it was only formed a few years before I joined, like 2010. And it's just a fast-paced office, and we're producing maybe 3 to 6 shows at a time between eight people, and that's with digital drawing, that's with the construction drawings, the design drawings, the visual art, the wallpapers. It's fast. And being thrust in that department as an apprentice, wow, you know that's a tough thing.
Well, that was just the first hurdle. I remember in my first week I got to see a show in tech, and I was just blown away. I was like, this is what happens behind the scenes. I never knew this was a thing. And
have you found, since you've done CAD drawings for theatre and done the mechanisms, has the magic died for you? Because that's the question I get asked by my family all the time. Has the magic died?
Never. Absolutely never. I find a big part of my joy and happiness when I do these shows and I draw these shows is seeing my work come from computer to actually on stage and just bringing it alive. It's like you get a storybook, and you know when people produce films out of those stories, it's seeing the work come alive, and there's something so joyful for me seeing that. And even with the little models, I'm like, oh, it's a little there and it's big there. And I still get really kind of giddy about that sort of thing.
See, that might be a good TikTok thing, to get the little model and then just pan up to the big set. There you go. Yeah. There's National Theatre's next marketing campaign. or any theatre for that matter.
But no, it never gets old. Never gets old. And I also feel like a massive accomplishment as well, you know, seeing it from start to finish. And seeing, you know, things don't always go swimmingly.
Yeah, I want to build upon that point. But, well, building on the swimmingly, because obviously the apprenticeship is a certain period of time. Mm. And it was a level two.
It was a level two.
Which organisations could offer, to my knowledge, different levels of apprenticeship. And then from there, you can either carry on by levelling them up. And I know that in the IT department, I think they did because they wanted to. And I know that organisations do. I suppose the hardest thing is when an organisation just wants to offer that singular level. What, in the graciousest of ways, it's almost like your contract's come to an end. Was it kind of like that? Did you have like a preparation period of like, just let you know, this is your kind of your timeline remaining? I know that's quite a bittersweet memory possibly for you, because it's the next stage in your career and probably quite hard. You know, you had the City and Guilds, you had the CAF who was supporting, I imagine, throughout the duration of the apprenticeship. Were they good at preparing you for kind of what would you change? Like, would you have wanted it to be a bit longer? Were you quite grateful that you kind of got, you know, and go, it's your career now?
I did feel, you know, they wanted me to spread my wings and fly, because they could see that I was like, you know, just rustling in the nest and being a bit afraid to put my tail out there. And
you've got to. In theatre, you really got to.
Throw yourself in the deep end and see if you're going to sink or swim. And that is true for a lot of my career. I've had times where I've sunk right straight to the bottom, and I've had to find, you know.
You know, we won't touch base on the darkness so much, but drafting, I'd say, as a whole, and maybe not realised, it can be quite dark sometimes because you feel a lot of pressure. So you completed your time at the National. You know, there was a transition period where you for the first time, were probably looking for your first job in theatre. And there were a few roles out around the time, if I remember rightly, because we talked about this. And you landed somewhere. And it's quite tough making that move. Like, I've made that move maybe a few times in my career, and it's never easy.
I was very frightened, I'm not going to lie.
Rabbit in headlights.
The National had been my home for 15 months, and I had formed really good friends and relationships there. And So I got a role as model room assistant at the Royal Opera House in Covent Garden, which is also a different calibre of theatre.
Yeah, it's a totally different boat, isn't it?
Because the National is more of, I would like to say, contemporary plays and...
Well, that's all down to the artistic director, but...
Well, yeah, but they're all plays and sometimes musicals at Christmas time. Whereas the Opera House is ballet and opera, and very traditional ones, and sets that have... And sometimes they're not necessarily new sets. They're old sets that have been around for about 40 years.
Yeah.
And just being touched up with a bit of paint and then thrown on stage.
But from our perspective, the CAD is the same. Like the process.
Oh, absolutely. Like
the paperwork, maybe the processes, but the stylization.
I think the biggest stage that I worked on at the National was the Olivier, but nothing compares to the size of the Opera House stage. It's huge.
You feel like an ant when standing in the middle of it by yourself.
I do. I think I have a brilliant photo of me on, like, before we went into lockdown, standing right in the middle with a hard hat on, just on an empty stage, doing a star jump, and I just look very small in comparison. It opened me, and, you know, these shows have been done for about 30, 40 years, and they have their old paper drawings, hand drawings. Mm-hmm. So I got to experience that for the first time too, which There is something very sentimental and lovely.
Oh, there's something so special about
hand drawings. They're beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Michael Vale, Peter Pan, Bristol, Old Vic. He did Peter Pan at Bristol, Old Vic. All his drawings were hand drawings, and it was just so lovely to see.
I didn't know that was a form of drawing until I went to the Opera House.
That's really interesting. So for me, I did, before I even touched CAD, we had to do hand drawings. And then it was kind of like, similar to when I started CAD training, it's like, oh, Aunt Lei is amazing. You can turn stuff on and off. And it's like, when you're doing it by hand, it's like, isn't this a pain in the ass that you got to do 90 degree, you know, get the ruler, get the set square out, get the protractor to get the angle. I think at every level it's a skill. Maybe this is an old fashioned view. I like where someone's like flymen, you know, theatre flying. People who go into automation, there's people who go straight into automation, but I was lucky enough to do hemp, then counterweight, then automation. And having that progression almost like from, you know, I suppose the computer, going back to the old Pentium 4 where, you know, you had like Doom 2D or whatever it was, and then going to like Call of Duty Modern Warfare, it's night and day in terms of what we can do now. You're just about that, you know, I'm a bit older, but...
Yeah, I'm part of that generation.
But where you've gone from the Nokia 3310.
And I grew up in a period where I didn't know anything else, like the internet was already a thing.
Did you have dial-up?
Yes, I did have dial-up, and I did have floppy disks. I remember taking my homework in on a floppy disk.
Oh, no, sorry, teacher. My homework got deleted. I left it by a magnet in my bag for my science project.
No, I didn't use that one.
That was a classic. Don't think I was old enough to take schoolwork in on a floppy disk. So I'm impressed you were taking schoolwork in on a floppy disk.
That was my ICT work, homework. Oh. And I put it in on a floppy disk. Okay. And then it became CDs. But I remember cassettes as well.
Okay, that's good. And then, of course, the life and death of mini disk.
See, I didn't have mini disk.
I never had a mini disk, but I remember them coming in and being really popular. And then it was like, what is it? They lasted for about 6 months before the first iPod came out or something stupid.
You remember
Zune player?
Zune. Everyone thought that was going to be a big thing, but iPods.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2, nice little, was it a classic Zune player in Guardians of the Galaxy? Now they're probably worth a fortune, so if you've got one, check it out. So
anyway, we're off topic.
Off topic, and I'm just going to try and draw us back. You know, good production manager there, bring us back to the subject. So... You know, we moved on, and you've moved on, and where you are now, you've gone through a few, you've gone through a few employers in the nicest way without sounding wrong.
Oh, yeah, no, I went off to, the contract at the Opera House was only about 2 years, and that role is always kind of a graduate
FTC,
role.
Fixed-term contract kind of thing.
Yeah, to kind of train people up. And so it was really fitting for me, and I was incredibly lucky to get it. And I then, towards the end of those 2 years, I dabbled in a bit of construction work because I knew we did some back at the National. Yeah. The office at the Opera House, they had two separate offices rather than a combined one. So they had a construction drafting office down in Purfleet where their workshops were. And a model room where the models come in and you draw from the models, which was based in Covent Garden. So I wanted to see, because I came from a world of combining them both, yep. I wanted to, you know, dabble back into it. So I did a few work experience days down in Purfleet and got drawing a bit of a show. I think it was La Boheme. It was a new La Boheme, and had, learned way, way more intricate construction stuff and engineering stuff, and learning all the weights of metals and sizes of wood and sizes of metal and integrities and stuff like that. It was quite interesting because that's something that was completely new to me.
I think it's fair to say, although... You know, our program remains the same between the two. The stylizations of the two drawings are very different. Obviously, one being design and one being construction, but I think equally as valid and as skilled. The construction side, you just get asked a lot more. Like, as you say, you got to calculate the weight of everything you draw quite often. And that can be challenging. That's particularly when they say, oh, can you just quickly give me the weight of that? And it's like, it's going to take me like 3 hours. Because I've got to work it out and break it down. And it's like, how accurate do you want that to be? Can it be within...
And that's what part and part with, you know, working with you now has been a real eye-opener. You know, we have... You have showed me these great ways of doing that, you know, within... you know, 20 minutes.
The dark side of the force.
Yeah, and, you know, quickening my pace and streamlining things and doing things, you know, to a higher standard than... I wouldn't say higher standard. No, that higher standard is not the word.
It's a different standard. In being freelance, the expectation's different because you're almost paying a premium for a freelancer. Mm. You know, if you're not doing it internally, there's often... It depends on the organisation. Some organisations don't have their own draftsman. Sometimes it's a freelance production manager who wants a draftsman. If it's an organisation that's bringing you in as an additional resource, you do feel the pressure. You need to be that little bit... I've always felt that I need to be that little bit above what the standard expectation is, because you are a premium, you're a luxury. And that is one of my concerns coming into 2021. You know, we are 2020 at the moment. It's been a tough year. I suppose if I call myself a premium resource as an external person, it's going to get harder for people to justify to bring in that resource, even if it's needed. So you're going to be, I think there's going to be a greater pressure to produce faster, produce more accurately. Because at the end of the day, we're human. You do feel that pressure to produce better quality drawings, and, you know, the expectation is higher and the turnaround time, and, you know, you make a mistake. We know, definitely made a few measuring mistakes, or when you're doing dimensions and if there's a glitch on the base view where it throws it back into one-to-one, and oh my god, it's like it's the end of the world.
I remember a show I did, not me personally, thank god, but it happened, and
yeah, quick, get out of that one.
It was a very costly mistake.
Well, when you consider that some of the stuff that we draw, and I suppose anyone who is in drawing will understand that, you know, although we put in systems in place of reviewing drawings, and then the guy on the workshop floor or the head workshop guy will check the drawings as well before they divvy them out. Guy or girl, I should say, sorry. They can miss the mistake just as much as we can. It could go through three people and the mistake's not noticed by one. Or someone makes an assumption that that's what's meant. And I know that there's been floors, whole walls... You know, and these can be £5,000-£10,000 worth of stuff done. And then you're sitting in a room with the head of production, the workshop manager, and you're sitting there going, so how did this happen? And you're like, I made a mistake. Or I can see here that the program didn't click that and I didn't notice it at the time.
Do you find that you have... way more respect for people when they put up their hands to say, I've made a mistake, rather than blame others?
Yeah, I think, you know, I will admit, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have an instinct to defend myself. And I'm probably, I'm getting better at that as I get older, and more used to it, particularly as a freelancer. It's really hard to hold your hand up.
Because that's your name and your integrity on the line.
Yeah, I, you know, recently, in fact, this year, I did a job, and I had to redraw some plates for laser cutting. And, you know, it was the guy said, quick turnaround job. And it looked like a quick job, 4 hours, you know, just redraw about 10, 15 plates with folded components. And it was like, yep, fine. And two plates looked very, very similar. And I messed up on one of the holes, on one of the plates. So one of 15, and probably, like hundreds of holes in these things. There's one hole that was out by 5 mil. Still a horrible experience, and you just gotta hold your hands up and go, I did check it, you know, which is even worse because you know you checked it and you still missed it. But at the same time, you know, I put in, particularly on emails like that, just going, can you just check these for approval before you machine them? Just check, because obviously you've sent me source file in part handwritten, part CAD. Can you just check everything's right before you fire away? If you're happy, fire away. If not, let me know and I'll do the amendments. They fired them straight through without looking at them. which, you know, they know me, they kind of go, we trust him, it shouldn't be a problem. But it happens, you know, it could be one in 10 jobs, it could be one in 50 jobs. Hopefully it's not one every job. But at the end of the day, we're human and mistakes are made. And we, as a group, as a collective, as humanity, we have to remember mistakes are made. And it's hard in a high-pressure situation, particularly when it's a financial mistake. And as a young business, and you're freelance as well, I should mention currently, I don't know if you feel this, I feel guilty when I make a mistake. It keeps me up. It does. And I struggle with it still to this day.
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. I 100% agree. I struggle with mistakes that I've made, you know, 3 years ago, and I'm still thinking about it.
And I think there's, as you say, there's clients that, I'm not saying there's good and bad in everyone. There's good clients, there's bad clients. There's clients who go kind of like, dude, you messed up. You know, I really need you to come through on this. And you kind of go, I'm sorry. And those are the ones that really kill you. When the client's like, well, you know, you're going to pay for this. And it's like,
yeah, I deserve that.
Like, yeah, okay. you know, and as with everything, it's good days. When you hear nothing, everything's perfect. And I suppose that's the, I would imagine this is the same in any industry when you're a CAD guy. And even production managers, project managers, but you know, we're talking about CAD primarily on this cast. When there's nothing wrong, you hear nothing back. Silence is golden. When you hear something back, it's like, oh no, oh no. It's very rare that you have someone come up and go, hey, that was awesome. You know, I literally slotted that together and it was like 10 seconds. And you're like, what? And when someone comes up and says something like, what? What do you say? There wasn't a problem? You're coming with not a problem? That's weird. I find that weird.
Yeah, because I did a bit of construction work and everything, I decided, oh, that's a really fun route. I'm really mathematical. I like problem solving. And construction just seemed to, you know, hit the right spot.
What do you prefer, design or construction?
Oh, now that's a question. If you had asked me that question a few years ago.
I think if I'd asked you that question maybe a year ago.
Yeah.
Given our recent discussion,
we'll loop back to the answer.
Oh no! I'm gonna hold you to it. I want to hold. Do you have a preference? If I said to you, Sarah, I've got a job. Do you want to design draw it, or do you want to do design and construction? What would you go?
For me, there's no straight line down the middle.
Okay, it depends on the show.
It depends on the show. There's no straight line down the middle, because one show could be, you know, heavily orientated about, you know, engineering or light, like big lighting things, which I have not much experience in, and so it's not necessarily my forte, and so I'd feel like I would struggle very much, and that's when I would be like, Ollie, and ping it over to you. Whereas other shows have been a mix of both, of doing the design drawings and a bit of construction, which I really enjoy doing, because I get to have an input into the construction side, because I have that knowledge and experience, as well as throw in my creativity and keep the integrity of the design intact, which I think is why me and you work so well together. Because you are very engineering side, construction side, problem solving, and you know, I like to think I'm like a little bit like that too. But there are times where I draw something and you're like, oh, why have you done it like that? And I say X, Y, and Z, and you're like, oh, okay, what about this? And you're like, oh, I'm like, oh yeah, that'd be great. And then there's other times where you draw something and I'm like, oh, come on, Ollie, peel it back a little bit. You know, we've still got a design here. Can't put, you know, X, Y, and Z in there.
I think that brings me back to one of the things I most remember when I first started. It was, obviously, in the last podcast, I talked about the story of a piece. But one of the things a workshop manager once said to me is, he to this day, he has the greatest respect for us purely because of the blank canvas. You know, we can be given a 1:25 scale model, but as soon as you open up AutoCAD and you look at that blank screen on your template with nothing in, it's the direction you go from there is completely your own. And it's as unique as your fingerprint, I think, anyway. I look at drawings and I can certainly work with working with people for quite a while, I can tell who's drawn that without looking at the title block, because I recognise the style of the drawing. So I know a Sarah drawing relative to a Jeff drawing. You know, I know, because we all have our individual styles and approaches. I'll let you in on a little secret when you're talking about construction and engineering. I'm actually hate doing doors.
Oh, same.
One of my biggest pet hates is doors. And don't expect, I don't know why. Doors, not a fan of. can we have no doors, please? It's all the tolerances, because it really depends on who's installing it, how's it been installed, what hinges they bought on the day. And there's draftsmen out there going, well, it's just
what I have learned with doors. When I worked for after the Opera House, I worked for a scenic construction company. What they said to me quite a lot of the time was just said, Sarah, don't worry about drawing the door. We've done millions of doors. Just draw
the hole.
Draw the hole and we'll do it. which isn't a good practice, I have to say.
Yeah, but it's a valid truth. When you look at the cost of the drawing time, the bench time, particularly, you know, I've come from the more charitable organisation background, although being paid, I don't do it for free, I should make that clear. Charitable organisations have, and particularly producing houses, you know, you're allocated hours, you're not paying people by the hour. When you're looking at the commercial side, the scenery builders, you know, your time is money. So you sitting there for another 3 hours, God forbid 3 hours, 1 hour, drawing a door, when the bloke on the floor can do it in 30 minutes without a drawing, I'm going to say skip the door and just give it to the guy on the floor, because I've saved myself your time and his time, because you're then able to move on to the next piece, which you'll need information from you on. One of the podcasts I want to do is actually Know Your Workshop. I'm going to try and get hold of a scene shop manager and just chat about the relationship with draftsmen in the shop, and how that relationship is and what it should be. You know, I think certainly at one point there was that relationship where you're the draftsman, don't go and talk to the draftsman, send a single point of contact instead of sending several points of contact. And it's like, I'd rather anyone come and talk to me and ask me questions. If I've made a mistake, I want to hear about it, because that's the only way I learn. Like, if you've got a preference, it's like, why'd you do that this way? And I can, at least then I've got the opportunity to go, oh, because I thought of this, this, and this, and this. And they can go, but what about this? And then so there might be something in there that I go, actually, yeah, you're right, can we switch that? And I've learned something, and they feel as if they can communicate.
Communication is key when it comes to the production process, I believe. Everyone just overlooks and forgets sometimes, because there's such a mad rush to get it done, that they're like, oh, okay, we'll just do it this way. I'm not saying that all productions are like that.
The tough thing, it all has to be done by email. Even video calling, like, everyone wants to see that trail of the conversation. So when did that conversation happen? At least with emails, you can kind of go, oh, that. And it sounds awful, and I even hate myself for saying this right now. You know, it's almost like a liability thing, because at least you can say, I said that this would not work, or, you know, we had this discussion about changing the material, and I hate the arse covering of it. But I understand why organisations want that. Rather than a phone call, just to go, oh, if we change that thing to that thing. It's different when you're in the workshop, because you can nip down to the floor and talk to the guys, because that's like a last minute thing, and then you'll update the drawing retrospectively if you get a chance. We all update the drawing retrospectively. That never not happened. But it's just having that trail, which you never could do with people on the floor, because they're not checking their emails, they're building the thing. So it's, you know, you've almost got, I want to say, old school when you're on the floor, and then we've got to be really modern and up to date when we're in the office with the clients, the designers, the stakeholders, so that they, but it's also trying not to make it feel surgical and that they feel engaged. So it's a really, really fine balance in that. So you've spent a couple of years within organisations. You know, you've been employed, you've done fixed term contracts, you've moved to a scenery workshop, which was another contract.
It was actually a permanent position.
Oh, it was a permanent position. Okay.
It was a permanent position.
And you decided to move on for whatever reason.
For whatever reason, I decided to move on and decided to take the plunge. I was with them for about 2 years, and then I took the plunge into freelancing.
How was that?
Terrifying, I'm not gonna lie. Standing on my own 2 feet was very scary, but I knew it was time for me to do that. I have met a lot of people along the way and a lot of people that supported me and wanted me to succeed. And that was true, especially because one of my first freelance jobs was a designer that I had previously worked with. And she caught wind that I was going freelance. And she said, right, you've got to come and do this for me. And she was my very first job. And then the Opera House caught wind that I had also gone freelance. And they asked me back as extra help as they had lots of new shows and they were struggling. You caught wind and you called me up and said, I need an extra hand. And it was so I've been freelance for about almost 2 years now. This last year and into this year, I was riding on a real good high because I had a lot of work and I was very proud of what I was doing and succeeding in what I was doing. And then there were times, you know, where it was difficult and there was a dry period, as you do in the freelance life. There are times where the work doesn't come in, and riding the wave is what I like to say, riding the wave.
Living the dream.
Yeah, and it was exciting, and I got to work on so many exciting projects and different projects and meeting new people and growing in my confidence a lot more.
Some of the projects you come across, because you're that additional resource, sometimes I've always felt that I've actually picked up more interesting projects and more challenging projects over the last 2 years because, you know, the extra help on those projects is the specialist projects that people often need help with. I'm not saying every project is every project is spectacular, of course, in its own way, but you get to see the really unique stuff. And that's one of the things I've really enjoyed about being freelance. The one thing I don't enjoy about being freelance is the cost, you know.
The running costs.
The running costs.
It's great when you're under an organisation, but yes, when you're an independent person, it can get a little pricey.
Yeah, you have a few drinks one night, you go, I'm going to go freelance, and then you go, you know, you go laptop shopping the next day, which is exciting, and then you buy your laptop, which is a cost, and that's...
You've got to store the laptop.
No, that can be anywhere from £500 up to £6,000, depending on how crazy you want to go. We won't comment too much on that. But there is one fixed cost you'll always have, which is the software. Now, we're both Autodesk users. I think we can comfortably comment on this. You know, when you've got a fixed cost of at least AutoCAD per year, you know, that's £2,000 a year.
Yeah.
Before you even woken up and gone to work. Which is... Oof. It's like, surprise. So totally making that freelance thing is kind of I need that X amount up front before I even think about that. And then when people go, how much do you charge? It's then, oh, I've got to factor in all of this stuff now. You know, it's not that just me. It's not just my labor cost. It's my laptop. It's my mouse. It's my space mouse. It's my Autodesk software. It's my this, that, and t'other, which... I had someone comment to me once, you know, oh, why do you charge so much? It's like, well, because I've got to pay for all these bills. It's like, what else have you got to pay for? Surely you just turn up and I know some draftsmen don't have their own laptop or license. You know, they'll turn up at clients and the client will provide it. But for me, I've always just gone, I want to be able to work anywhere, anytime, and just be able to go, yeah, I can help you, rather than go, oh, I've got to come in to do that. I suppose in some ways being that type of draftsman allows you to be... make it sound like an awful thing. It's a good thing in some ways. It gives you that 9-to-5. You know, you can't take your work home.
I'm sorry, 9-to-5? What is that?
It's this thing that people believe that they can do. No. it's a funny thing moving into freelance. And anyone thinking about it, do your sums first is my biggest piece of advice. Obviously, don't let that put you off. If you want to do something, you can do it.
Oh, yeah. Like, I had to assess the situation that I was in, and think about it financially. But a big thing that drove me into it was, will I be happy doing this? Will this move me forward in my career? Yeah. And so I just thought, you know, my happiness is worth so much more. And if I trip and fall, there are people around me to pick me up and dust me down. And I'm not saying I'm relying on them, But it's good to have people to lean on and friends to support you.
Do you ever get lonely in the freelance life as a draftsman? Freelance in general, but I want to pick on the draftsman line because that's often, we're often the people tucked behind, I don't want to say in a corner.
Weirdly, no. Since COVID has kind of made everybody stop working or lose their jobs, me being one, I say me being one, I was on PAYE at the Opera House, so I lost that kind of freelance in residence kind of role, air quotation marks. Since COVID has sort of stopped theatre, I am finding all people that I have previously worked with in drawing offices, designers, design associates, we have all had this connection, you know, this big rupture, this volcanic explosion of there is no theatre, there is nothing to do, and we all want to check each other out and be like, are you okay? And supporting one another, because the arts is such a big part of all of our lives. And it's not until I've had all of that love spread that it's made me feel, oh yeah, I'm not alone in all of this.
The arts community is fantastic in that way, even with people you've not heard from in years. It's like, are you okay? It's been really nice to have that community, and particularly on Facebook groups, even LinkedIn, there's WhatsApp groups, and just even receiving an email, there's a great sense of community through this, you know, all in a very similar position. What I found really interesting chatting to some people is there's no animosity towards people who have got work. You know, the few people who have managed to find some work in this, it's been really positive. It's been really reinforcing. Oh, great. Really pleased to hear that you're surviving, or, you know, you found something. There's no kind of like, I should have got that job, or no. Damn you. It's all like, that's awesome. I'm really glad you're doing okay.
I find that if I see somebody on Facebook posting, oh, I've done this show, I actually got work and did this, I want to commemorate them. I want to praise them and be like, this is fantastic. Great job. Keep going. You're doing what everybody else is struggling to do. We're really proud of you.
Keep the dream alive.
Exactly. Because we have to. Because if we all, you know, fight with each other and say, oh, I should have got that job, you're doing a terrible job, we tear down the very thing that has brought us all together. We need to keep it alive and keep it positive, I think.
Well, I think we've covered apprenticeship. If someone was listening to this now and was considering apprenticeship over university.
Absolutely.
Well, that was a fast response. I wasn't expecting one that quick. What advice would you give them? What would be the final word of advice?
I would say, don't underestimate yourself if you're second guessing. I'm just basically talking to a younger version of myself.
That's cool. I'm sure there's one out there.
If you are a practical learner and you have a passion for what the apprenticeship is in, what is the harm? Because if you don't get it, university can be a second choice. There are other opportunities out there. And to all those people that think that not going to university is a failure, that is completely wrong. Absolutely wrong. I am an example of that. I have done really well. I've been very fortunate. I've done well in my career as an apprentice, starting from where I've been, and not having a university degree. That doesn't take away your achievements. It doesn't take away what you are capable of and how hard you will work at all. Apprenticeships are so good, and I'm finding more now. People are fully understanding the potential of apprenticeships, and a lot more companies are delving into that because they want kind of a grow your own. I remember when I was at school, I went back a year later while I was doing my apprenticeship for an awards evening. And everybody had their names in the programme of, you know, this person is doing this bachelor's degree at this university. And my name wasn't in the programme, which I found very upsetting and somewhat insulting.
Just wait for that 10-year reunion. Oh, so where have you worked? Oh, I've worked here. Minor name dropping.
It should be on the same level.
As you say, I think over the last few years, it certainly has definitely increased. I don't want to say increased in level because it was never at a different level. Its reputation has improved.
Value is more valued.
Admittedly, had the university prices stayed where they were at maybe the 3K mark, I think people would find it less attractive just by an outdated view of it. But I think now the prices of university have gone up and people are actually starting to question value for money, I think the option, as you say, it's opened people's eyes because they are looking. They are thinking, what is value for money?
And there are some things a university degree cannot teach you, but an apprenticeship can.
Well, on that note, I'm going to call it quits with you, Sarah, because you've been a fantastic guest and I know what we're like. We'll talk for the next 3 hours about anything and everything. I just want to say thank you for joining me on this podcast, and hopefully you will come back and maybe we can chat about workshops or something like that further down the line. And of course, to all our listeners, please hopefully subscribe if you've enjoyed this podcast. You can find us on Instagram at oct.ltd. You can find us on Facebook at OC Theatrical. We have a Twitter at OC Theatrical. So do get in touch, do ask questions. If you've got questions for Sarah, I'm sure I can relay them and feed them back in the next podcast. And everyone out there, have a good Christmas, good New Year, depending on when you're listening to this. And catch you on the next one.
Stay safe, everyone.
This is the Caddis Faction Podcast. Caddis Faction.